So tell me, how healthy do you think your sense of smell is? Have you thought about it much? If you have a smell dysfunction, I know you do. But if you're able to smell, you probably don't think about smell health all that much. You assume your nose works and will continue to work, right? In fact, our sense of smell gradually starts to decrease in our 40s and dramatically decreases by age 60. And most of us don't realize it until it's too late or becomes a problem. Well, I want to encourage you to think about your smell health more, a lot more, because it's directly connected to your brain health and your overall well-being. And if you have issues with your sense of smell, then I want you to be aware of what options you have that could potentially help improve your smellability. In today's episode, I've brought in a medical expert to tell us all about olfactory health, how to gauge it, and how to improve it, and about olfactory dysfunction. What causes it and what treatments are available, and about new and exciting olfactory research, clinical trials, and yes, even technology that's currently underway. My guest today is otolaryngologist, also commonly referred to as an ear, nose, or throat doctor, Dr. Zara Patel. She's director of endoscopic skull-based surgery and associate professor of otolaryngology at Stanford University here in the Bay Area. She's got an amazing resume of experience and publications that I invite you to check out. But why I'm excited to have her on is because she's a true champion for our sense of smell. She's truly committed to finding a cure to help all patients with smell dysfunction and even potentially heighten the sense of smell for everyone else. I want you to listen closely to what she has to say because I think there's something for each of us to learn, no matter what our current olfactory function is. So I won't keep you any longer. Enjoy my conversation with Dr. Zara Patel. This is An Aromatic Life, the podcast that aims to shed light on our beautiful sense of smell and increase its profile in a culture dominated by sight and sound. My name is Frauke Gallia. I'm a certified aromatherapist and smell coach who spent over 20 years in and around the fragrance industry. What I know for sure after all these years is that our sense of smell is powerful, yet is so underappreciated. There's so much we can do to harness our sense of smell to be well. So join me as I explore this mesmerizing sense from all different angles and learn what it can do for you. Enjoy the show. So I want to welcome you on the podcast, Dr. Patel. Thank you so much for coming on An Aromatic Life.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm excited to be here.
Well, you're an ENT, ear, nose, and throat doctor, and I wanted to have you on because I think my listeners could really benefit from a medical perspective on our sense of smell. You know, this podcast is all about our sense of smell, so I think you're a perfect guest to have on. I've got people from all different backgrounds. I've got the congenital anosmics, the acquired anosmics, the parosmics, you know, the whole smell dysfunction spectrum. Sure. But mostly I would say I have people on who do have a sense of smell. So, you know, it's going to be important for everyone, just anything and everyone connected with their sense of smell. So I wanted to start with a simple question that I ask all my guests. I mean, it's simple to me, but it might not be simple to some of my guests is, what does your sense of smell mean to you personally?
Yeah, well, I think that I always have had a heightened appreciation for my sense of smell because I do have a very acute sense of smell and taste. And I've noticed that from when I was very young, that it was more acute than other family members of mine. And that I could appreciate sort of more nuance to different foods or different odors and areas that we were, different perfumes. And so I've been aware of my own ability to smell for a whole lifetime. And then when I got out of training and I was ready to be a physician and surgeon, and I felt very prepared by my, you know, residency and fellowship to do, you know, take care of all sinus issues and all skull-based tumors. And then slowly but surely, these patients began to filter into my clinic who could not smell or were having smell dysfunction. And I realized at that time, which is over a decade ago now, that I didn't have anything to offer them. And, you know, compared to my own appreciation for my own sense of smell, that made me feel so strongly that I wanted to find a way to help these people. And so that's why smell has become such a big part of my life, my own appreciation and my desire to help those people who don't have what I have.
Oh, that's wonderful. How did you even get into the field? Because you could have chosen a lot of different topics or, you know, areas of focus, I should say. So
yeah,
how did you get into it?
Well, it really is that, you know, I am not just a smell doctor. I also treat chronic sinusitis patients and I take out tumors from the skull base endoscopically. So it is part of my rhinology, meaning, you know, specialty of the nose practice. And that really is why, because when I came out of training, there was really nothing that we had to offer people like this. You know, patients would come to doctor's offices and be given maybe a short course of steroids. And if that didn't help, they'd say, oh, that's it. There's nothing more we can do.
Right.
And unfortunately, that still happens all over the country and the world.
Yeah.
But that's not the case anymore because of the last decade of research that I have done and that many others in the community have done. And so, you know, at that time, I began to do my own research. I visited Thomas Hummel in Germany, who is, you know, one of the gurus of clinical olfactory research, and learned a lot from him and brought some of his ideas over to the United States, which were not being used at that time over here, and studied them again in a sort of a more real world context compared to his very research-based context. And so, you know, that's how I got into this field of research long, long ago.
Excellent, excellent. So just a quick question, because I've had anosmics ask this, and I'm curious, since I have you in front of me, when you're studying medicine, you know, the general, before you get into the more specialized, is there a lot of focus on sense of smell? Do you learn a lot about sense of smell versus the other senses, I should say?
Yeah, I would say probably not, because you know, the field of olfaction is a relatively young field. We didn't even know the basic mechanisms of smell until the 80s. You know, compare that to what we have known about our visual senses, our hearing, which have been, you know, research has been going on for decades and decades and decades. You know, Richard Axel and Linda Buck won the Nobel Prize for smell in 2004. That's, you know, just 20 years ago. It's a very, very young field. And that's probably why not much attention has been paid to it. It's also true that, as you probably know, you know, if you just took someone off the street and asked them, if you had to lose one sense, which one would it be? And I'm sure they would all say smell, because so much focus is based on how we see each other in the world, how we hear each other in the world and speak and communicate and things like that. But it's only, I would say, and I know this from my patients, it's only once you have lost the sense of smell that the importance of it becomes so obvious.
Yeah. And certainly in the last year, that's become even more obvious, hasn't it? And we'll get into that in a minute.
Sure.
I wanted to start with healthy sense of smell, right? If you're a normosmic and you have a healthy sense of smell, you want to maintain it. As you get older, your sense of smell starts to kind of decline naturally, as does your hearing and sight, everything, right? So it's a normal thing. But from a clinical perspective, I wanted to get your thoughts on what's your definition of a healthy sense of smell and how do you guys assess it?
Yeah. So the tools we have to test smell right now are fairly rudimentary, actually. We use these scratch and sniff smell booklets and smelling pens and things like that to test identification ability, discrimination ability, threshold ability for smell. And so, you know, there's normative data as to all these, you know, hundreds of patients who have normal sense of smell, what they score on those types of tests. And that's what we compare people to when they come in for an objective type of smell test. But as far as, you know, a healthy person having a normal sense of smell and then maintaining that sense of smell throughout their lifetime, I would say that it's really everything else that you do to maintain your overall general health. Because as we're learning more and more, the olfactory system is the canary in the coal mine of brain health.
Yeah.
You know, it really gives us a window into the functioning and processing ability of the overall brain. And so we know that, you know, people who are at the earliest sign of neurodegenerative disease, even subclinical dementia, patients like that will have lower smell. But not just that, people who have diabetes do not have as good a sense of smell. People who have cardiovascular disease and small white vessel, you know, brain matter changes do not have as good a sense of smell, because all of these things are necessary and paramount for a healthy functioning olfactory system and a healthy functioning brain. And so all of the things that make us healthy overall as human beings will likely preserve a healthy functioning smell.
Very good. Very good. So are there things that people can do at home and in every, you know, I always tell my students, or, you know, I talk about it on the podcast, smell everything, be engaged with your sense of smell. I mean, basically, really, it's kind of like a smell muscle, right? Your sense of smell is a little bit like a muscle. What would you suggest people do?
Yeah, I mean, I think that we can sort of take a cue from sommeliers, people who are, you know, expert cheese tasters and you know, restaurateurs, chefs. People who exercise their smell and taste on a regular basis definitely have a more nuanced ability to pick up on, you know, more fine differences in smells and tastes. And so definitely exercising that part of your brain, just like exercising any part of your brain, will make it sharper and more fine-tuned.
Yeah, because it's always those three things. It's the threshold, identification, and discrimination, right? Those three things to kind of keep in mind. And all of that can be done by just smelling, first of all, and identifying it, and then comparing it to other things, right? Yeah. And just making sure that you smell more of things so that you get that threshold lowered, which would be a good thing. So let's get into smell dysfunction, since that's a big part of what you do, right? People who come to you have already identified that they have something wrong with their sense of smell, right? I mean, they come to you for a lot of different things, but specifically what we're going to talk about here today is sense of smell, obviously. So there's a broad spectrum of olfactory dysfunction, from no sense of smell to, you know, phantosmia, even hyperosmia. I would love to know if you can get, you know, people coming in for that. But what types of patients do you tend to see coming in?
Yeah, I see the whole gamut of patients.
Really? Yeah.
You know, people who, you know, it's much more obvious to people when they have had a very acute sense of smell and then suddenly it's gone. So I would say that's the vast majority of people I see in my olfaction clinic, is people who have had some sort of acute loss, a post-viral loss, such as COVID-19, a post-traumatic loss, a post-anesthetic event type of loss. There's a lot of different things, metabolic problems, inflammatory systemic disease processes that can play into it, cancer patients after chemotherapy or radiation. There's a whole host of different ways you can end up with loss of smell, but the people who notice it most are the people who did have a great sense of smell before, and then suddenly it's gone. I will also see patients who have been told to come in by their husbands or wives, and it's a more general gradual loss that they have experienced. And suddenly, you know, one day their wife will say, "Hey, the stove is on fire. Can't you smell that?" And they can't. And they, you know, realize that maybe they haven't been able to smell things for a long period of time, maybe over the course of years, that they've been having a gradual loss. And then there's also people who are congenital anosmics, who read or hear that there's more research going on now, and that there are people actually who are experts in this at this point now, and they come in seeing if there's anything new that we have to offer them, even though they've lost their smell or had no smell for so long. Because I think just hearing from people around them how smell affects their lives, even they are curious about how smell could add to their own lives.
Sure. Or, I mean, definitely. because I talk to a lot of them as well. So I think you might know that I work with the charity Fifth Sense.
Yeah.
Right. And that's why I've been connected with a lot of people with lots of different smell dysfunctions. And do you know what a common theme is? You'd be surprised to know the common theme, and I don't want you to take this personally because I think you're doing a great job, but they they don't feel understood a lot of times. People who come into the doctor's offices and they don't feel heard, you know, they get told, okay, you can't smell, get over it, you know, like, or there's nothing we can do for you. You're just going to have to live with it. And it's a real depressing thing.
It is. And I hear that also, unfortunately, all the time when people come into my office, because I'm almost never the first doctor that someone has seen for their loss of smell.
True.
You know, so they do tell me that their primary care doctors or even other general ENTs or otolaryngologists have told them that there's either nothing that can be done or that it's no big deal, that they'll cope, they'll adjust. And to be happy that it's not some other sense that they lost. And I think that that's really harmful, you know, for patients to hear that. It diminishes their experience in a way that's really not true and not mirrored in all the science and data that we know about how important sense of smell is for people's quality of life and well-being and human connection on so many levels. And so, you know, I definitely, take the time. I actually allocate more time for my smell patients than my other patients, because it is a lot to unpack and a lot to talk about. And it's not just everything that in the way that it's affected them, but it's also that it's so hard for other people to relate to what they're going through.
Yes.
Not just other physicians, but also their friends and their family, who don't really know how to understand how it's affecting them, or they don't know if they should talk about their enjoyments of smell or not talk about it. People start withdrawing from social interaction because so much of our social interaction across cultures, across geographic regions, across societies around the world, almost always when we get together as friends, as families, even as strangers, it's over food and drink.
Absolutely.
And when you're not able to enjoy that, you know, people really start pulling away and becoming more isolated, which can lead to depression and anxiety and a host of other, you know, problems.
Absolutely. And there's also health in the sense of they start to eat more poorly, right? Because they're relying on their taste. If they, you know, some might not have taste even, but generally, if you have a smell dysfunction, you still maintain your sense of taste, right? So, but there's issues with that too, isn't there?
Yeah, I would say, you know, the vast majority of people who lose a significant amount of their smell are not able to enjoy the flavor of food, because the basic tastes, sweet, salty, sour, bitter, umami, that's what you get from your tongue. Everything else about the flavor of food, our ability to distinguish between chocolate and vanilla and strawberry and raspberry, chicken versus beef versus fish, that's all based on our ability to smell the food. And so I would say, you know, people can taste, but that's a very, very basic sense, actually.
I mean, I know that the congenital anosmics will tell you that they have a really heightened sense of taste.
Yeah.
Which I don't know. How do you?
Yeah, I agree that people who are congenitally anosmic are likely developing their taste in a much different way than most people develop taste. I would say it's kind of similar to, you know, people who say, you know, once they become deaf, they develop, you know, their sense of touch, their ability to read lips, that like all the other senses, when you lose a sense, are able to become more developed more finely. Congenital anosmics, their neuronal connections and synaptic connections likely developed in a very different way when they were very young to deliver more of that flavor and nuance of food via their tongue, because they don't have the olfactory bulb to depend on.
So obviously with the emergence of COVID-19 and a primary symptom being smell loss, right? There's a lot more focus on our sense of smell now. That's probably, to me, one of the bright spots the pandemic is that suddenly, wow, people want to do research on sense of smell. I'm so happy. Can you talk a little bit about what we know so far about how COVID-19 affects our sense of smell and what the recovery rate is for smell loss?
Yeah. So very early on, people assumed that COVID-19 was entering the actual neurons, the olfactory neurons, and entering the brain that way. But that's not actually the case. The virus, the SARS-CoV-2 virus, it binds to receptors not on the neurons themselves, but on the supporting cells, what we call the systentacular cells within the olfactory epithelium high up in the nasal cavity. And that is the cell population that becomes damaged and has difficulty. So this is why when someone has a COVID-19 infection, there's a lot of sudden inflammation in and around those neurons and they lose their sense of smell. But the majority of people, about 70% of people, are able to recover and relatively quickly. However, it's right around 2, 3, 4 months out from the infection that suddenly people begin again to have difficulty, lose their smell again, or start developing these parosmias or phantasmias, meaning distortion of smell or smelling phantom smells that are not really in their environment. And that is because the olfactory system is unique in all the other cranial nerves and that it does have this inherent regenerative ability. And that regeneration of olfactory neurons and replacement of our olfactory neurons takes place probably every 2 to 4 months. And there's a lot of different factors that affect the timing of that. But when that regeneration takes place, it's those sustentacular cells that are supposed to help and guide that regeneration. And so when you don't have that help, when you don't have the signals to regrow new nerves or tell those nerves where to go and which nerves to connect on, or the nerves that are inhibitory nerves or interneurons, those types of nerves that sort of tell the nerve which signal to send, when to send it, how that signal should interact with the other signals sent from other neurons, all of those very complex interplays, the sustentacular cells are helping with all those signaling mechanisms. And so when you have damage to those cells, that's why we see these other problems. And I would say that, you know, about 20 to 30% of patients who have COVID-19 will have some long-term problems with this.
Wow. Okay. So when patients come in with smell loss due to COVID, what do you generally recommend for them? Do you recommend smell training?
Yes, definitely. You know, the wonderful thing about olfactory training is that it has been shown through multiple studies at this point, very well done studies, that it can help smell loss from multiple different etiologies. So many different causes that get people to smell loss can be improved with olfactory training. And, you know, that runs the gamut from post-viral loss, post-traumatic loss, Parkinson's disease-related loss, age-related loss, so many different things. And so, you know, and that's because it really is what we were saying before. It's just a structured smell protocol. It's training your brain, exercising your olfactory system to, you know, wake back up that regenerative capacity and stimulate the olfactory system to regenerate again, make those correct connections again, work again in the correct fashion. So that is, I would say, the mainstay of what I have people start. And it is important the way that people do olfactory training. I think a lot of people think that just smelling things randomly in their environment is going to do it. But I always tell people that, you know, really taking some time to focus, not be distracted by other things in your environment, but focus your memory on what did that smell used to smell like to me? What is this supposed to smell like to me? That's really what allows that connection to occur. It's not just some random thing in your environment that's going to help. And so I definitely tell people to do it. I ask them to do it at least twice a day. Probably the more often they do it and the more variety of smells they include and incorporate, the better outcome they're going to have. But of course, time is a limitation for everyone and how much they're able to do it. So that's one thing. Secondly, through research that I've done in the past before COVID was ever here, but focusing on post-viral or idiopathic, meaning we don't know why people lose their smell, adding a topical steroid irrigation to olfactory training definitely increases the amount of patients who will benefit from the olfactory training significantly. And this is likely because there is, even when we don't see a huge amount of inflammation, not a bunch of polyps or a bunch of pus sitting there in the olfactory cleft, even if there's a slight subtle amount of inflammatory change, we know that neurons don't work very well, and they certainly don't regenerate very well when there's inflammation around them. And so bathing the neuroepithelium in this anti-inflammatory milieu can really allow for the right environment for these nerves to regenerate and function correctly. And so budesonide is the topical steroid that we use very, very commonly in chronic sinusitis patients. And so I did a randomized controlled trial looking at using that with our smell patients. And so that's another mainstay of post-COVID-19 smell loss therapy. Finally, the one other thing that I recommend is based on another randomized controlled trial that I ran, but in a different patient population. So, you know, as I mentioned, I also do endoscopic skull-based surgery. So, you know, tumors that are at the base of your brain, right at that interface between the brain and the sinuses. So pituitary tumors, for example. And we realized that there are a certain number of patients who have that type of surgery that have some long-term smell issues after that surgery. And I wanted to figure out how to help those patients. And so we did a randomized controlled trial. I started it when I was at Emory in Atlanta, Georgia, and continued it when I came back here to Stanford. And so it's a multi-institutional, many different rhinologists and neurosurgeons taking part in these surgeries. And we found that without any intervention, up to a quarter of patients after that type of surgery will have some smell problem. But what I utilized as an intervention was omega-3, high dose omega-3. And I used it because at that time when I started the trial, there was a lot of really interesting information coming out about omega-3 and its ability to help with nerve regeneration and other neurologic sort of research, you know, peripheral nerve injury, crush injury, spinal injury, dementia. And so that's why I found it interesting to study, because this really is a nerve injury inflammatory regeneration problem. And so when I added high dose omega-3 to patients and randomized them to that arm, there was a precipitous drop, a highly statistically significant improvement in those patients, down to 4 to 6% instead of a quarter of our patients. And so, you know, this is a totally different patient population, but I would argue that until we have studied it in this population, it's a very low downside, low side effect profile type of supplement that you can use and try to see if it's going to help people with COVID-19 related smell loss or any other type of smell loss for that matter. It's really just patients who have some sort of underlying bleeding disorder or are on other blood thinning medications, because omega-3 can thin their blood. Those are the people I don't put on that.
Okay. Okay. So if there are people listening who are suddenly getting very excited, I mean, obviously they should go talk to their ear, nose, and throat doctor, right? Or talk to your doctor.
Yes. And I would say that not only should they talk to their ear, nose, and throat doctor, but maybe come armed with the data that a smell expert has suggested this, because again, unfortunately, there still are many primary care doctors and general ENT doctors and even rhinologists who don't necessarily know all the options for treating patients. And so, you know, I would come as an advocate for yourself, saying that, yeah, maybe look it up, you know, look up this trial and see if you can recommend this for me. Because if they don't live right next to someone like me who they can come and see directly, unfortunately, there's not a lot of people that know everything that can be offered.
Okay. So maybe we can at least put links to certain studies where they can, you know, bring that with them to the doctor. That would be great. So I'll put that in the show notes. Hey, I just wanted to jump in here and let you know about a smell training program I offer once a quarter. It's a habit building program designed for those who've lost their sense of smell, have a very weak sense of smell, or are experiencing smell distortions. The next session starts on January 9th. It's an email-based program, so it can easily be integrated into your schedule and daily life. And importantly, it allows you to be located anywhere in the world to join. You'll get your daily email first thing in the morning. The program includes pre-program setup, support and guidance, an e-journal and workbook to record progress and stay motivated, 21 days of inspirational emails, an optional smell buddy to help keep you accountable, and 3 recorded motivational mindset coaching videos from me. The best part is when you sign up, you'll be invited to join future smell training sessions for ongoing support and motivation for free. My treat. So if you or someone you know has lost their sense of smell, has a weak sense of smell, or even smell distortions, and you're finding it difficult to stay consistent with your smell training, I invite you to check out my habit building program by going to the link in the episode notes. So let me ask you, you know, we've COVID-19, because that's only been in the last year, but there's a lot of people who've had smell loss, even post-viral, and, you know, smell loss for a longer period of time. Do you think smell training or olfactory training would work for them even?
It can. I would say that, unfortunately, it is true that one of the biggest predictors of prognosis, how well I am able to bring someone's smell back, is duration of loss before definitive intervention. Yeah. And so that's why, you know, I'm so glad to be on this podcast. And I talk about this as much as I can to other physicians and people around the world and the public, because it really is a sad fact that many times people are told there's nothing they can do. So much time passes. And then it's not until way, way later that they actually come to someone who tries something like this. And so I would say that although it's possible for someone after a year's worth of loss to regain smell, it's much less likely.
Okay.
And so the sooner people can get started on all of these, you know, potential interventions, the better chance they have for regaining their normal smell and avoiding the development of things like parosmia and phantosmia. But you know, when I see someone who's had smell loss for years, I don't tell them there's no chance, because I really don't think that we have enough data at this point. You know, we don't have the numbers. We don't have, you know, thousands of people who are 10 years into a smell loss and try them all in olfactory training and see how many people improve. We don't have that data. And so because it's so simple and easy to do, and there's really no downside, I tell people about it, even if they have had many years of loss before they come to see me.
I agree. I don't think you should give up completely, right? And olfactory training is such a simple thing you can do at home. It's low cost, low, you know, there's really no downside, right?
Exactly.
To trying it.
Exactly. And I would say that, you know, these patients in general are so desperate to get their smell back or have their distortion go away that they're willing to try almost anything. And that's the danger, actually, because there's a whole host of things that are purported online to miraculously cure people's sense of smell. And not only have we actually looked into all those things, and either they're not helpful or they can actually be a detriment, right? They can actually cause people to lose further ability of smell. And so even really great natural things like, you know, spraying zinc up your nose sounds like a great idea, but that causes an irreversible loss of smell that we don't have a cure for. So, you know, there's lots of things out there that people should be wary of.
Okay. Very good. Yeah. I think it's so important that people try the olfactory training as soon as they feel like they have no sense of smell, because there's such a psychological element too that I find with the people I work with, because I do smell training to make it a habit, right? Because it takes time and you have to do it for the duration. And even I have family members who got COVID and lost their sense of smell, and they're like, yeah, I'll think about doing it. And I'm like, no, you don't understand. The sooner you try to do this, the better chance you have of getting it back. But there's a mental hurdle a little bit, right?
Yeah. And I think that it is also true that, you know, so many people who are affected by COVID-19, especially in this way, are otherwise young, healthy people. And they've gone through their lives sort of, you know, they've gotten colds before and they've had a problem with their smell, but it's always come back. And they're relying on their own healthy immune system like they always have throughout their lifetime. I think actually that's one of the problems with why there's such a low rate of vaccination in our 18 to 39 year old patient population, because people really do trust in their own bodies and their own immune systems, which they should to a certain extent. You know, people know their own bodies best, but unfortunately, every so often there comes along an infection like COVID-19, which that doesn't really care, and it doesn't really matter that you're otherwise young and healthy and that you otherwise have a healthy immune system. It can still damage you in this way. So, you know, I think that that's great that you're encouraging people to try and make it a habit.
Yeah, thank you. Okay, so one last thing, which is super exciting. You're now officially an inventor. Congratulations.
Thank you.
So yeah. Can you tell the listeners a little bit more about, you've created, and you'll tell me more about this, but the device where I think you're stimulating the regeneration of olfactory nerves, right?
Yes.
So tell us about that.
So, you know, this is very early times.
Yeah. But it's still exciting.
It is very exciting. I would say it's very preliminary data, and it's really based all on animal data at this point. So it's not ready for prime time. It's not ready for clinical intervention. So unfortunately, I can't tell all your listeners to come to my clinic and have this done, because there's a lot more work that I need to do before it's ready for that. But I will say that early data using, you know, a rodent model, basically in a rodent model which has olfactory damage, so their olfactory system has been damaged, if you expose these animals to an electrical stimulation via this device, when you compare them to control animals that have just had a sham, you know, going to sleep without having the stimulation, these animals do much better on behavioral olfaction assays, meaning food finding times, things like that. When you put them in a little arena and have them dig around to try to find a food pellet, they're able to do that much more readily after the stimulation versus not. And when you look histologically at what the actual olfactory epithelium looks like in these animals compared to control animals, you can see much more regeneration and structure again within the olfactory epithelium versus the non-stimulated animals. And so, you know, these early preliminary data are enough for me to have filed this provisional patent and now start working more on development of the device. And, you know, there's a whole host of different things that I can imagine using this device for also. And so I'll definitely let you guys know more as time goes on and I'm able to do more research. I will just put it out there for your viewers that it's really difficult to do research, even in these times with COVID-19, even in these times when there's more interest, it is still really difficult to get funding and get the time to do this, because, you know, 80% of my time is spent in the clinic and OR. And so I myself, just one person, am not going to be able to, you know, move this field forward.
Yeah.
And so I need to hire postdocs and, you know, PhD students and other people that can work in the lab while I'm in the operating room to do this. And that's why, you know, philanthropic donation to me or other researchers that are in the field and support for research like this is so important. So I'm just going to put that out there for your listeners also.
Everybody who wants to donate, please. it's so important. So are there any other promising studies or treatments, anything in the field that people can start to get excited about? I know, you know, there's a long way to go. You just mentioned it, but what else is out there? What's happening?
Well, I myself am running a randomized clinical trial right now on COVID-19 related loss or post-viral loss olfactory patients and using PRP. I don't know if you've heard of that. That's enriched plasma.
Okay.
And so, that is basically where we take blood, we draw blood from someone, and it's their own blood, and we spin it down to separate out the different parts of blood. And we get to this really platelet-rich plasma which has also a huge concentration of growth factor. And we know that we need these growth factors for regeneration of tissue. People use PRP in all sorts of different medical fields. Orthopedic surgeons use PRP to inject into joints to help cartilage regrow in people with arthritis. People use it in cosmetics. If you've ever heard of the vampire facial, people like put it over their face and have all these
yes. things
on their skin. That's PRP that's being used. Oh. People inject it into the scalp actually to help with hair growth and people with hair loss. So there's a whole host of different ways in which PRP is used. And we've realized in all these different fields that it really does give this boost to your body's own natural regenerative capacity. And of course, going back to our olfactory system, that's what I want to do, right? I want to boost the olfactory system's own inherent regenerative capacity. And so that's why I became interested in PRP even before the pandemic ever occurred. I did a pilot study using PRP, and that was a very small number of patients. I really wanted to know from that first study, is this safe for me to do? I don't want to cause anyone to have further damage to their smell. I don't want to cause any of these distortions or alterations of smell. And I don't want to cause any tumor growth in that area, because of course you have to think about that when you're giving growth factors to any.
Yes.
And so I was able to demonstrate with that small number of patients that it is a safe and feasible thing for us to try. Now, also in that small number of patients, I did see some interesting findings as far as being able to improve threshold of smell. But again, without a control arm, no placebo, very small number, that's not something that you can make any conclusive statements
sure.
about.
Sure.
But it was enough for me to want to investigate further. And so that's what I'm doing now, running this randomized controlled trial. And this time I'm injecting three times, not just one injection, but three times separated by 2 weeks, and you know, testing smell before, during, and after. And so that's the trial that's currently ongoing. And my fellow who I trained here at Stanford back when I was doing that pilot study, she's now at UCSD and she's a second site. So people could enroll at either of our sites, and we might be bringing another site on soon as well. So, you know, I think that there's been some interesting comments from patients, but we don't have enough data yet to know whether this is going to really be an effective intervention or not, but definitely I'm excited to find out at the end of our data collection and analysis.
Excellent, excellent. Well, that actually makes me want to ask you, because I know there are a lot of people with anosmia and different ranges of anosmia, who would love to participate in studies. Is there ways that people can get involved?
Yeah, so clinicaltrials.gov, I think I have to update that website actually, because I don't know if I've updated it since we started enrolling, but that at least you can get, you know, my contact information to ask about the trial. And then, you have to consider a few different things. Number one, I need an objective test. It can't just be, you know, someone who thinks they've lost their smell. I need someone who knows objectively based on an upset or some other smell test that you've had in a physician's office, that you do have objective loss of smell to be able to be eligible.
Mm-hmm.
Patients need to have at least 6 months of smell loss before they enroll in this study, but not more than 1 year.
Okay.
The reason for that is that, you know, there is, that as we mentioned, there is some spontaneous amount of resolution from smell loss that people have after a viral event. And I don't want that spontaneous resolution to confound my findings. I don't want to have a bunch of people who would have recovered anyway, because we really want to know, is this going to help people when we give it to them or not? And so that's why I'm not enrolling people too early. Now, certainly there's some amount of spontaneous resolution that could happen after 6 months, but it's a very, very, very low number, and it's not enough to confound my data. So that's why I'm willing to enroll people after that. And as I already mentioned, it's much less likely that you can help someone after 1 year of loss. And so that's why I'm limiting it to the people who are most likely to benefit, so that we can see whether it's going to help those patients. If it can help those patients, then certainly we can open it up after the study to any amount of time.
Sure, sure.
We want to, you know, really see if it's going to work, it's going to work in these patients. So that's why this constriction of timing. And the last part is, you know, because it's over, you know, three injections over, you know, separated out by 2 weeks, and you have a test at the beginning and a test about a month out, you have to maybe be near me unless you have enough money and time to fly back and forth where you are in Stanford. You'd have to be around me. And so there are certainly some people, I have had people fly out from New York, from Alabama, from Montana. There are people who do have the wherewithal to just stay here for 2 months and go through that whole thing. Especially now with work from home, more people able to do that. But I know that's really difficult for a lot of people. And so I just want everyone to keep that in mind when they think about whether they're going to be a candidate and want to enroll in a study like this. I would love for everyone to reach out and enroll. But yeah, clinicaltrials.gov, and I'll try to get to that on my sabbatical to update the website.
Because I know even congenital anosmics, they'd love to be a part of things. There aren't too many studies, I think, that get done for that group, unfortunately. Yeah,
it is unfortunate. But I will say, you know, that congenital anosmics are most likely to benefit from trials or studies going on with stem cell therapy, you know, actually trying to replace someone's entire olfactory system.
Yeah.
That type of research is also very early in stages, very preliminary, and it's going to be years, unfortunately, before we are able to actually trial that in patients. But I would say that, you know, there is hope on the horizon, and you know, the pace of scientific and medical research is just always picking up. You know, it's going at an exponential rate compared to what we were just 10 years ago. So, you know, maybe soon.
I think that's a nice, hopeful, optimistic way to end that. Thank you so much. But I'd love to end, as I do with all my guests, to ask you three personal questions, if you don't mind. I sent these to you ahead of time. I don't know if you had a chance to look at them. I don't know if they're kind of hard for you, but just an easy one. What's your favorite smell right now?
Yeah, so this is kind of a random one, and one that maybe a lot of your listeners won't be familiar with, but I hope once travel opens up, everyone can acquaint themselves with this wonderful, delicious smell. So there is a fruit in India. So both my parents are from India. I was born and grew up in St. Louis, Missouri, but both of my parents are from India. And so we went and visited there many times growing up as a child. And there's a fruit called custard apple, which is delicious, which many people haven't tried, but some have. And I haven't had it in so long. And I just realized I have a current obsession with bubble tea.
So many in the Bay Area right now.
And I just realized that at this very particular bubble tea shop, if I combine jasmine green tea with lychee flavoring, just a quarter sweetness, and mango jelly, I can recreate the smell and flavor of custard apple.
That is so cool. You're like a little flavorist in the making.
That is my current favorite smell and taste right now.
So it's called custard apple?
Yeah, that's the name of the fruit itself.
And they don't export it at all. I've never been able to find it.
There is a fruit that is similar, but not quite the same in South America, which is called chirimoya, which people are more familiar with, but that's has a more tart flavor to it. Custard apple is much more sweet, and the consistency, the texture of the fruit, the flesh around all these seeds is just much more delectable. And so I encourage anyone who ever visits India to try it.
Very good. Very good. I love that. All right. Do you have a favorite scent memory that you could share with us?
Sure. So as many people have from their childhood, a sense memory that relates to one of their parents. My mother, I'll say that my mom does not have as an acute sense of smell as I do.
Interesting, okay.
And so And so both she and my sister, when we were growing up, they would use all sorts of perfumes all the time. We'd go to the mall and they were always spraying themselves with these things. And me having a very acute sense of smell, I couldn't stand it. I would have to like step away from all this odor that they were putting on them. But she did have this very light rose scented lotion that she would wear at night. And so of course, I remember she was putting me to bed at night and just, you know, in and around this very light, fragrant scent that I could appreciate with a very acute sense of smell.
Yeah.
Whenever I smell a very light rose scent, it brings me back to my mother. So that is my favorite scent memory.
Oh, that's so nice. I love that. And what would you say are five smells that best describe you?
this is the hardest question you sent me. And I have two kind of complex smells and then three more basic smells, more primary smells. So, you know, when I think about smells that describe me, I think about both, you know, what makes me me and sort of what do I enjoy most, right? So I live in an area here in the Bay Area, very close in a very heavily wooded by redwoods area, but it's also very close to an open space. And so when I go hiking with my husband and my puppy, which we do very often throughout the week, there is a particular time of year where spring is changing into summer, where you are at the interface of this heavily wooded area of redwoods and this big open grassy area. And there's this warmed by the sun sage smell mixed with a fresh grass, as grasses are growing in the springtime, mixed with this very light scent that comes from that very light green ferning that the redwoods are doing at that time. That combination is this very sort of fresh, open, wooded smell that always sort of evokes the sense of possibility, a sense of optimism. And so that's one of the smells I would say could describe me.
Oh, she's smiling so much right now. She can see her face. That's wonderful.
And then, so that's one, I know that's a complex one. Another complex one is something else I love, and a location that I love is the beach. Really any beach, but a warm, sunny beach would be my preference. And so if you can imagine the smell of that fresh, briny ocean wafting off the waves, mixed with the warm sunscreen that's kind of a coconutty scent, mixed with my coconut and pineapple frozen cocktail that I have in my hand, that combination, that smell, you know, just is so happy, fun, peaceful, relaxed. That smell, I think, also could describe me sometimes. And then finally, three more simple smells. I love to read, and I have always loved reading. So that smell when you open an old, well-worn novel of the paper, old paper from a novel wafting off the page. I love that smell. And then the smell of a freshly mown lawn. That is the way that St. Louis smells in the summer in my neighborhood, just freshly mown lawn, because everyone's mowing their lawns all the time. And that just brings me back home.
So I can relate to that because I grew up in Chicago.
Yeah,
and Midwest, exactly. similar thing. We don't get that so much here in the Bay Area.
You don't. It's a very distinct smell that you have to go back home for.
That's right.
And then finally, because so much of what makes me who I am is me being a surgeon, that potent, sudsy, soapy scent that I smell every day when I scrub into the OR, that is another smell that defines me.
Wonderful. I think that's perfect. Look at that. We got to know Dr. Patel a little better. Wonderful.
That's great.
Thank you so much for coming on An Aromatic Life. Maybe one day we can have a follow-up, because I'm sure people are going to have lots of questions for you, and I'd love to maybe at some point in the future. We'll see. But for now, are there places where people can maybe follow you or connect with you? I know you're on social media and you share wonderful information there. So can you tell
Tell people where I'm primarily on Instagram. It's at Zara Patel _MD. And I'm also on Twitter, although I'm just newly on Twitter. So I'm only starting to post there a little bit more. So mostly Instagram and Twitter. And I do have a Facebook doctor page, which is also Zara Patel MD. So the social media handles are at Zara Patel _MD, both on Instagram and Twitter. And I'm happy to post links to those studies that we talked about earlier on your website. And thank you so much for having me. It's been a really wonderful time.
Thank you for joining me on An Aromatic Life. If you're interested in learning more about your sense of smell from all different perspectives, subscribe to the podcast and invite your friends too. And it would be really helpful if you could rate the podcast so it helps others find it too. I also invite you to check out my website, falkaromatherapy.com, where you'll find information about workshops, courses, and other programs I offer. And make sure you grab my free audio training, How to Smell to Be Well, which you can download from my website. Until next time, remember to smell everything and have a wonderful day.